PPI.org.
Great listeners, this is KFEI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFEI.org. You're tuned to Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Miguel is my engineer. Thank you, Miguel. Charlene Dahl is my research team. Thank you, Charlene.
Good evening,
tonight,
everyone.
The topic is trans. Great. Topic is transplant and transplanting during COVID time. Dr. Raja Kandaswamy will be with us. He's joining us. Dr. Kandaswamy is a professor at the University of Minnesota Medical School and medical director of the Solid Organ Transplant Unit at MHealth Fairview at University of Minnesota Medical Center. Good evening, Dr. Kandaswamy.
Good evening, Sam.
Thank you so very much for giving your time and joining us. We greatly appreciate it. I think this is really an important topic to cover. Times are changing so much, and with that, so much medical stuff changes too. Can you just start out by giving me just a little brief history on you?
Sure. Sam, as you introduced, my name is Raja Kandaswamy. I'm a transplant surgeon at the University of Minnesota. I direct the kidney and pancreas transplant programs at the university. I also direct the inpatient transplant unit. I'm also involved in education of future transplant surgeons. I direct the transplant fellowship. I am involved in major national and international organizations in the field of transplantation. I grew up in India during my early years and immigrated to the West in the late 80s, right after medical school. I did a brief stint in psychiatry residency at the University of Toronto, late 80s, early 90s, then switched from psychiatry to surgery in Washington, D.C. That lasted through the 5 years of training. I got fascinated by organ transplantation. I was exposed to the first liver transplant in the District of Columbia back in 1991. And I was an intern who held a retractor for 16 hours straight during a liver transplant and fell in love with it.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was the bug that bit me and then decided to specialize in organ transplantation. Decided to seek the best program that's available, and certainly University of Minnesota had the reputation of being one of the best programs in organ transplantation under the leadership of John Najarian and David Sutherland back in the 90s. And so I applied and came here in 1997 and did my transplant fellowship, became a transplant surgeon, and was retained to be a fellow here as a assistant professor, and then have moved up the ranks now to be a professor and head of the kidney and pancreas programs.
Well, we are glad to have you. So thank you. Can you tell us currently how many organs can be transplanted?
Well, there are various organs in the body that can be transplanted. The most common, of course, is kidney transplants, and that's the most commonly performed transplants, followed by liver transplants. So those two probably predominate. Other transplants that are performed are pancreas, small intestines, heart, lungs, and also more recently, uterus transplants, which have been performed
sporadically.
Yes.
Huh. In addition, I did not know that.
Yes, yes, that's been done. It's not very common, but it's been done in a few selected centers. and we have an interest in it as well. The other transplants that are done are vascularized composite allografts. I'll tell you what I mean by that. Those are those belong to tissues that come along with their own blood supply, and those include hand hand transplants for people who may have lost their hands due to accidents and trauma. And the second is face transplants. So those are other types of transplants that are being performed. Now, the cell transplants in addition, which I'm not covering in this particular session, which include eyelids and, you know, there's bone marrow and there's certainly skin grafts, which is the most common type of transplant. So.
Huh. Okay, well, then prepare for another show. let's see. So I think that's fascinating. I'm just curious how successful are the uterus transplants?
The uterus transplants are a transitory transplant, if you will. They have a very defined purpose to provide a childbearing option,
right.
A biological childbearing option for the mother.
Right. Right.
And so the need for long-term success is not as important for uterus transplant. It has to take you, first of all, it has to be technically successful in that the operation has to go well, the blood supply and things have to connect okay, and the uterus has to thrive. Secondly, it has to get the ability to get pregnant. And thirdly, it has to be able to bear a full-term pregnancy. And once that's done, then the uterus can be removed, basically. So it's only done in a handful of cases so far in the United States. And there's been the Swedish are the pioneers in that. So I think there's a small, it's a small start, but there's a potential for it to grow in the future. It all depends on competing technologies as well as to in vitro fertilization and now surrogate motherhood. And it's a whole area. We look at the biology of uterine transplants and concentrate on whether or not we can make it work.
That is fascinating. All right. Well, we got a whole lot to get to, so I can't concentrate too much on this, but at some point that would be a fascinating topic. So what are the organs that can be donated without someone having to be a dead donor and donating them? I know kidney is one, theoretically liver too, right?
Yes, you touch upon an important classification of organ donors. There's a one is a living organ donor versus a deceased organ donor. If you're talking about living donation, which is what we'll discuss first, a healthy volunteer can donate one kidney, since we have two kidneys. At least the majority of us, or the great majority of us, are blessed with two functioning kidneys, and so are perfectly capable of functioning with one kidney for the rest of our life. So we could give one up, and that's the most commonly performed living donor transplant. As far as liver, there's only one liver, but fortunately that's the largest organ in the body outside of the skin. And therefore there is enough reserve in the liver to be able to give up to one half of the liver or even a little bit more if required, if you're a healthy donor. So a partial liver donation can be performed and is being performed in the country with fair regularity. And it's a bigger operation for the donor than a kidney, but it's certainly doable. The third organ that's performed is a pancreas transplant. Pancreas is done in cases where someone has advanced diabetes and has problems with diabetic control. Often it's combined with a kidney transplant, because diabetes is one of the leading causes of kidney failure. So again, we're only blessed with one pancreas, therefore it'll have to be a partial pancreas transplant. And that's been performed less commonly. Intestine, a portion of the intestine has been donated and has been performed here at the University of Minnesota and a couple of other centers. And finally, lung. You could certainly give a lobe of the lung from a living donor and be able to utilize two living donors, in fact, to make a lung recipient well from chronic lung failure. So those are the organs where living donation has been utilized and have been successful.
I presume that there is a partial amount of our listeners who might be kind of freaking out as opposed to the thought of giving their liver and whatnot. But my understanding is that the liver can grow back, you know, can regenerate. So yes?
The liver has an amazing capacity to regenerate. In extreme cases, the liver can regenerate after losing 85% of its volume, which is an extreme example. Of course, we would not be pushing those kind of limits in healthy donors, but most donors can give up safely 60% of their liver, and the other 40% will gradually grow back and compensate to provide 100% of the function that the body needs.
Yeah. And so when you do the liver transplant, are you taking exactly half of the liver or only less than that?
So there's a variety of considerations. In a adult to child transplant, for example, where the mother or father donates to a baby or a young kid, you probably do not need to take anywhere close to one half. So the liver is divided into eight segments, if you will, one through eight. And we can just take two segments of the eight and do a baby transplant with that from an adult. From when you transplant from one adult to another, you may need more than two segments, and usually it's one half of the liver. And one half of the liver is not exactly a half because the right lobe is larger than the left. So if you do if you take the right half of the liver, you're taking probably about 60% of the liver, and if you take the left half of the liver, you're taking about 40%. Which one we take will depend on the recipient and donor size matching. The suitability of the donor to be able to donate 60% of their liver, and a variety of other factors. So yes, up to 60%, but many cases lower.
And so when you do that, then presumably, as you said, the liver can start regenerating. Will it make like it's the new part be like it's a whole new liver, or is it regenerating from what you already have? And if you already have an older liver, you're going to get an older liver regenerating?
It's not like the liver is adding new. Let's say you downsized from I don't know what a good analogy would be, but you downsized from a liver that's 1.5 grams down to 1 gram. I mean 1,500 grams to 1,000 grams.
Okay.
What can happen within 2 to 3 months is that liver that's now downsized to 1,000 grows back up to 1,500 and sometimes even more. It doesn't form a new, the cells hypertrophy, meaning they proliferate and they get, more functional and can compensate for the, rest of the missing liver. Now, it doesn't form any new blood vessels. The basic anatomical structures remain the same. It just gets to be larger to be able to accommodate the function.
Gotcha. Dr. Kandaswamy, I'm wondering, how does one become a donor? Can you talk us through the different ways that you can do that?
Yes, I will. There are two types of donation, as I talked about earlier, two types of organ donors. One is deceased donors, which is after your demise, and second is a living donor. I first talk about deceased donation. Of course, those choices are made while one is alive. For example, I'm a registered organ donor, and you can make that choice by signing up during your driver's license renewal. And in the last few years, both fishing and hunting licenses as well, you can sign up to be an organ donor at that time. And most recently, I was just told by LifeSource, which is our local organ procurement organization, that you can sign up through some tribal ID cards as well in the Indian reservation. So there's a variety of ways you can do it. And it's not prevalent across all tribes yet, but at least there's been a breakthrough with one particular tribal ID card, which is a great start. The more opportunity to become a donor, the better it is overall for transplantation. So I encourage people to discuss with their family and while they are alive and well, and it's not any different from planning a will. You talk about organ donation. It is very important to talk to family because you are not around at that time when the donation happens, and the teams will be talking to the family. And to the extent the family is already aware and agreeable, it makes the whole process go much smoother. That's the process of deceased donation. I can move on to living donation unless there are any questions about deceased donation.
No, I think it gets tricky talking to them if you hadn't talked to them before and they don't know what you want, and then it's a tragedy. But I do have a question real quick. So let's say you actually get old. You die because you're older, in your 90s. Would they actually use your organs then?
So the donor has to have healthy organs to be able to transplant. It does not, just because one is 90 years old and does not mean that all the organs are not healthy. They could have died from a stroke, which is a specific brain-related death. Mm-hmm. And so there is opportunity, although I don't think we've done any 90-year-olds. That's an extreme example, but we've gone out to 80 years of age in terms of taking organs from older people. So yes, advanced age is not a contraindication within limits of reason, provided the mechanism of death is not something that has resulted in gradual deterioration of all organs. If that's the case, then they may not be suitable donors. But in either case, the choice to become a donor is made well before you know what your mechanism of
the is. That's right. Well, and I do want to impress upon people that too, that my understanding is you can certainly donate and make sure people know if you can't, you know, they can't use your organs in a person, that research would be great.
Yes, absolutely. And there's we are constantly trying to learn more to advance the field and help future generations. So being able to utilize the organs that cannot be used for transplantation for research purposes is just as useful in many cases and just as important. And then there's also tissue and eye donation that can be done in patients. So there's a variety of opportunities when one signs up to be an organ donor, besides you know, the organs that I mentioened before.
All right. Well, I'm ready for the live thing now.
Yes. So live donation is fast becoming the most common form of transplant in the United States. The U.S. is the leader in the world in the area of live donation. And I think that really is the future for organ transplantation. Like I said, by nature, people are good and generous and want to help. It's just awareness as to what can be done and what are my options and how safe it is. And am I going to put my own health or my family's interests in jeopardy by going through an medically unnecessary procedures? To the extent we can educate on this topic and reassure donors that this is a safe option to go through, I think live donation is going to continue to grow. Live donation, first step to becoming a live donor in the United States, the most common form of live donation is in response to a recipient request. Mm-hmm. So most often you either have a loved one, a friend, a family member, a relative, or somebody who is in need of a kidney transplant, and people hear about it and then want to help that person out. So that's the most common method of finding live donors volunteering. The second has been where, and this has taken off in a big way. The University of Minnesota is a pioneer in this area. In fact, I was involved in one of the first such donation processes back in the late 90s, when we had people that showed up at our door and said, out of the goodness of their heart, they said, we read about kidney donation. We know that it's safe to do. I don't have anybody in need that I know of, but I'm sure you do as a transplant center.
Ah, yes.
Therefore, I want you to utilize my kidney to provide to someone in need. This posed a lot of questions for us back then, because it's easier when there's an emotional attachment and we didn't have a structure to be able to take organs from people who are what we called back then altruistic donors or non-directed donors, as we call them now, meaning they don't direct where their organ should go. Rather, it's for the goodness of society. And right. We transplant centers as good stewards of that organ, then utilize our transplant waiting list and the priorities that we already have in place to assign that organ to the best possible recipient without any favoritism or bias. So that program was started at the University of Minnesota. We did some pioneering work on it, the process of non-directed donation. And now we have done over 150 donors that way in the last 20 years at the University of Minnesota. And it is the largest program in the world in that particular subsect. And subsequently, a lot of other programs have followed our lead. And nationally now, a non-directed donation is growing, especially amongst young altruistic individuals eager to help people that are unknown to them. And it's a great opportunity to donate, and that program is growing. I want to touch upon this a little more in detail if I have time. But and I can come back to it later about live donation and non-direct donation. But that is another method of donation. There are ways to find information about living donation on the web. The National Kidney Foundation has some good resources. You can go to their website. The National Kidney Registry, which is the largest exchange for living donor organs in the country, also has some very interesting information and very detailed information. Their website is kidneyregistry.org to get information on it. And then our own University of Minnesota mHealth website, which is mhealth.fairview.org, has links to organ donation. And if one is interested in trying to see if they could be an organ donor, you could fill out a questionnaire at mhealth.donorscreen.org. And we would go through the screening questionnaire, and someone will call you back to talk over the process of trying to become a donor. It is by no means a commitment to donate. It just shows that you want to get some information and think about donating.
One of the things that always hit me funny, and this is my understanding, you correct me if I'm wrong, is that here in America, you have to opt into donating. And my understanding is in parts of Europe, you are just donating unless you opt out. Is this correct?
Yes, that's absolutely true.
Why? Why wouldn't they just have it the same here?
Yes. So this is as much an ethical question as it's a legislative,
I'll bet.
Legislative question. The most common shining example in the world that's cited is the country of Spain, where unless you, just like I said before, you go and sign up in your driver's license to be an organ donor, it's the exact inverse in Spain. Everybody's assumed to be an organ donor after they die. And if you do not want that to happen, then you sign up to opt out of organ donation. So unless you opt out, you are considered a donor. So the whole process is much more systematized, more efficient, and a high yield, and they have the highest organ donation rates in the world.
I bet they do.
Yes. So often, and it's in many cases, it's not bad, because people have not signed up to be a donor just because of the inertia of going through the process, discussing it, and actually actively signing up. But in their hearts, if you quiz them that whether you'd like to be a donor, the answer is probably yes. And so it works well in the great majority of individuals. But the ethical pushback has been this needs to be an active decision. Someone has to think about this. The system cannot assume that everybody wants to be a donor. Just as there is inertia for making a decision to donate, there may be an inertia for a decision not to donate and opt out, even though they may feel that way. And therefore, we do not want to err on that side. That's been the U.S. philosophy, and it's a legislative deal. It's the law. And there's been a lot of efforts over the last 30 or 40 years to try and propose changes to it, to go and to an opt-out policy. But so far, we haven't had that change.
Well, just so you can, I can air my opinion, I really feel like they should have this, because just like anything, there's so much lesser important things that you have to sign up for and say if you don't. Heck, half the time I have to check that I don't want junk mail if I don't want it. So to me, this is so much more important. If you don't want to be a donor, you should be able to just opt out. But just think of the, like you said, the high yield you'd have if people were just assumed that they were donors and then made that specific choice themselves if they didn't want to. I want to quickly touch on, you know, I know it's tricky when you need an organ. Obviously, you have to be sick. And if you're too sick, you can't get it. And if you're not sick enough, you can't get it. So where is that happy balance there, or not so happy balance?
Well, that's a great question. So organ transplantation is advanced and complex surgical procedures, generally speaking. And so there's two major risks of organ transplantation. Just like any operative procedure, they always come with risks. And the reason we undertake those risks is for the benefits we get at the back end of it. If you have a broken bone and you have to have an operation, there's risks to that operation, but you do it because that's the way you can use that limb again, or walk, or whatever the case may be. And therefore, you take the risk for the benefit. And in organ transplants, the risks are outweighed by the benefits greatly in most transplants. But that equation can be altered by the recipient's medical characteristics. If the recipient is very sick and their operative risk, meaning their risk of having complications or being able to survive the organ transplant surgery, goes up higher, there may be a tipping point beyond which the risk may be higher than the potential derived benefit. Of course, it's a hypothetical calculation that we have to constantly make in every clinical scenario. It's a challenge we face in many situations, and we talk to recipient families who are on the margins of candidacy because they are too ill to be transplanted and get through a transplant. It applies to all organs, and we like to transplant patients before they get to that stage. It's often limited by, I would say, the number one reason why there's a limitation to that is the availability of organs. If there was an unlimited supply of organs, hypothetically, in the utopian world, we would be able to transplant the great majority of people well before they get too sick to have a bad outcome from transplant, and would greatly enhance their outcomes. There's 120,000 people waiting for kidney transplants. That number was about 25,000 or so when I first started. When I first started in the field, that number was just 20 or 30,000, and that's grown every year by a great percentage. So we are adding to the list. So we cannot seem to be, making a dent on this list. We're barely keeping up. So,
and that's just kidney, right?
That's kidneys, yeah. And it's right. True for all organs. There's the number of organs available in most organs, the number of organs available versus the need. There's an imbalance with greater number of organs needed to get people freed up from their disease. So that's really the limiting factor. But yes, we like to transplant patients before they get ill. And that's where living donor transplantation makes a huge difference, because deceased donor transplants have to be rationed according to medical need or waiting time, right? So in liver transplants, for example, if there is a patient who's very ill and doesn't have a long time to live, they do get priority on the list and get moved up. So if you transplant all the sickest patients first, then by definition, you're setting up your system to only do patients that are very sick when there's a shortage of organs. You never get to the not so sick patients because you just don't have enough organs.
Yeah.
But if you have a living donor available, then you can intervene earlier, because that donor is donating to a particular recipient. And therefore, you can get access to transplantation earlier and do better. That's part of the reason why living donor transplants as a group do better than deceased donor transplants in terms of longevity and complication risk in all organ types.
I'm finding myself really juggling all the questions I have for you. So I'm having to pick my best ones, which is disappointing. I think we could make two shows out of this. I do want to get to what I said I would talk about in the email and talk about donating organs during COVID, because I think this pandemic has been a big deal for everyone, even anti-vaxxers. But it's a big deal, and people still get sick. In fact, I believe, if I'm not wrong, that COVID often messes with the heart and the lungs, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on. So talk about what the process, has it changed during COVID? Is there different things that you do? Talk a little bit about that.
Sure, I'll be happy to. So just to track back to the history of when COVID started, just to give your listeners a good perspective on how it all began. When things went down in March of 2020, it was, of course, a big shocker to the nation and to the healthcare field as well. And we, in transplantation, went into a dormant mode for a couple of months with except life-saving organs where patients would not survive. We had a freeze on elective living donor transplants for a couple of months until we figured out what this new process was and how it affects donors, how it affects recipients, and so on and so forth. So national transplant activity dropped greatly in that quarter of second quarter of 2020. But once it became clear that we started understanding the mortality risk, the morbidity risk, and how we could still navigate a safely transplant process through COVID, even though we didn't have all the answers, such as vaccines and more recent treatment protocols that have been in place, we were able to resume activity in the third quarter of 2020 for living donor transplants. And by the end of 2020, our living donor transplant volume rates were back to where they were prior to COVID. In 2021, actually, transplant volumes outpaced that of 2019, which is the baseline year you would compare to. 2020 being a COVID year, we not compared. Now, why did that happen? I think part of it is because there was a backlog, right? Because 2020 was a slower year, and therefore there were patients who hadn't received their transplants who were waiting. So there was an backlog of transplants that needed to be done. Plus, there were more donors in 2021. 2021 had some of the highest donation rates, both in deceased donation and in living donation nationally, which is terrific considering the country was still going through a pandemic. Maybe adversity brought us together and stoked the altruistic fires within people's minds. I'm not sure what the mechanisms were, but we had nationally a banner year in 2021 for transplantation. Mm-hmm. And so that begs the question which you asked, which is, how do you handle transplantation during COVID? How do you do it safely for both donors and for recipients? So we have performed over, I want to say, about 500 transplants since the start of COVID at the University of Minnesota. And we have not had, we have had one COVID-related post-transplant death in a patient out of those 400 to 500 transplants that we have done. So the rates of mortality is, while it was still there, one is one too many, but it certainly was not an explosion of mortality that we saw in transplant patients. And so therefore, we continued on transplanting patients. We did rigorous testing in patients to be sure that they were COVID negative going in. We did a few other modifications to the amount of immunosuppression that they would take, especially in the area of kidney transplants. And we screened donors carefully for COVID as well. prior to taking organs from them for transplantation. So we've been able to navigate COVID, I would say, pretty well in 2021 to keep transplant volumes at or higher than the rates that they were at pre-COVID. And I think that same trend is continuing in 2022. The biggest challenge seems to be how can we increase the utilization of organs from COVID positive donors, because right now, if you look at deceased donors, 30% of our deceased donor referrals from hospitals are COVID positive. That's one in three. If you have one in three COVID positive donors that are trying to, that have signed up for donation, when COVID first started, we would not take any of them. But over the months, we have learned that we can take many of them, provided they meet certain criteria. That's provided we know that they're not transmitting the COVID, the risk of transmission is low or none, provided we know that the organs that we're trying to take are not affected by that COVID, or the COVID has resolved. So that's what we are in the process of doing now. And we have done a handful of COVID positive donors into COVID negative recipients with no transmission. And it's happened in hundreds of cases nationally, with only reported transmissions in lung transplant, COVID transmission, because the COVID, as you know, is predominantly a lung infiltrative disease. It can involve other organs, but in no other organ has COVID transmission been recorded in the country.
So, okay. So then my question is, you would take somebody who has COVID and take, if they want to donate and they're a live donor, you would still allow that, or you wouldn't wait till they were negative, that they tested negative?
Live donation is different. I'm going to talk about live donation. I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay.
I was talking about deceased donation because there we do not have the option to wait. When a donor dies and they have had COVID, either we take the organ then, we can't wait for the next 3 or 4 weeks for their COVID to resolve when they're brain dead, because they are already passed and
right.
We cannot do that. So it is a time-sensitive judgment that has to be made. And there's no health consequence to the donor because they are already passed. But in a living donor, it's a completely different deal. If someone has active COVID, the first order of priority is to take care of the donor and get them better. Because COVID, while it seems to be running more benign courses in most patients, there's still some patients who do get bad complications and possible mortality from COVID. So we do not take COVID in prospective donors lightly. If any donor that we are in the process of evaluating ends up with COVID, we tell them to make sure that the COVID symptoms have resolved and there's a cooling off period of about 3 weeks, after which we would and make sure that they're fully resolved before we would take the organ. So no, we do not take it during the time of COVID, not because of the risk of transmission as much as to look out for donor safety. Our first priority in living donor transplantation is donor safety.
What about the long hauler COVID?
So we have had a couple of patients who have approached us who have had chronic symptoms with COVID, and our general advice to people is if you have active symptoms that's limiting your functional ability, it will limit your ability to get better from surgery as well, because it is a major operation. Living donation, even though it's done laparoscopically, it's meant to be a minimally invasive operation. It still involves going in there and getting a kidney from the deep recesses of your abdomen. And therefore, it will be classified as major surgery. So if you are already debilitated from chronic symptoms, recovery from major surgery can be complicated. I think the couple of patients that we saw, we have advised that they hold off for a while, but I think it will have to be done on a case-by-case basis, because as you know, long COVID is not a well-defined a condition yet. It seems to vary in severity, vary in its manifestations. Some people are minimally disabled. Some people are not able to move around very well. And so it depends on where they sit. But I think by and large, a patient has to be functional and well before they can donate.
So Len, correct me if I'm incorrect with what I heard in regards to the deceased donor. that you take the organs and you must have tests that you can do on them to confirm that they're not infected or they're not damaged, and then you can use those.
Yes, we do tests, and those tests are rapidly in evolution as we speak. There was a point in we do both nasopharyngeal swabs and in almost all deceased donors, they're usually ventilated and intubated, so we can get deep lung washings for COVID. And even if those are positive, if there's enough science to show that there is no invasive COVID disease in the tissues of the lung and or other organs, then we could potentially transplant those organs. And that's an area that's right on the cutting edge right now. We are just delving into the area.
That sounds a little scary to me. Yeah. That would be a little scary to me.
Yeah. Having said that, if we have 30% of our donors that are COVID positive and we are throwing away all those organs when there's an opportunity to use it, and knowing that that deceased donor had the desire to donate, we are beholden to them to try and explore every avenue safely. That's I would underline safely, to make every effort possible and to see how we can utilize those organs. And like I said, hundreds of them have been done in non-lung organs and with zero transmissions so far. And as of now, if the recipient is vaccinated, even if they do contract COVID, this is hypothetical, it hasn't happened. Even if they do contract COVID with the latest treatments, monoclonal antibodies, the antiviral medications, and if they've been vaccinated with pre-existing antibodies, we feel reasonably confident that we can get them well from the COVID. So we haven't had to face that, but that'll be your safety net if that should happen.
Ah, yes. I want to jump back, Dr. Kandaswamy, to, you know, you were talking about the whole COVID thing with donation, but I think you explained that pretty well, but I'm just curious because I think a lot of people get a little bit shy when they're donating if they're a live donor, especially like recovery time. So can you talk a little bit about how quickly, you know, donors recover from donating something?
Yes. So I'll talk about the most common form of donation, kidneys. There's, over 10,000 kidney donors, living donors in the country today on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. And so the donors typically go through I can walk through the process, but since your question relates specifically to the surgery, I'll touch upon that. I can walk through the rest of the process later if need be. Mm-hmm. The surgery is done laparoscopically, meaning there's a small incision just big enough to deliver the kidney. That's about 2.5 inches. That's either made in the midline or in the lower abdomen. And then there are two or three buttonholes, little laparoscopic portholes for laparoscopic ports to be placed. And we do most of the surgery by looking at a TV screen and looking at the insides of the patient and operating from the outside. The procedure is less invasive than an open operation that we used to do back in the 90s, which had a significant morbidity and a longer recovery. I would say most of our patients leave the hospital within 1 to 2 days. For example, I do donor surgeries on Tuesdays, and about one half of my donors leave on Wednesday, and most of the other half leave on Thursday. So they're home in 2 days. And then they stay the first 2 weeks. It's a little bit of limitations in terms of what you're able to do, even as far as activities of daily living. Mm-hmm. May need some pain medications and some laxatives to make sure you're regular. But after that, after 2 weeks, things start starting to feel normal. And at about 3 or 4 weeks, there's usually a day that they wake up and say, wow, I feel pretty much back to normal again. And so I see patients at 2 weeks and 6 weeks post donation. And usually at the 2 week mark, they say they are feeling better, but they haven't hit that point where they feel normal again. And by 6 weeks, they say, I feel back to normal. And it happened around the 3 week mark. And they're back to full activity by that time. So that's the normal course of post-transplant recovery. And in most jobs, many donors are high-functioning people. They have jobs. Unless you're a construction worker or a weightlifter or some kind of extreme physical activity vocation, you can go back to full activity in 6 weeks. And if you are at a desk job, mm-hmm. or you're an office job, which doesn't require much physical activity, you could go back in 3 to 4 weeks. But there is an opportunity to take up to 6 weeks off with most employers based on documentation that we provide. And I would say the majority of employers do grant that leave. In fact, there's legislation that's being pushed through to make that a law in Minnesota.
Really? Excellent. Yes. Excellent. Yes, that would be good. You know, that's right up there with the importance, like having a baby, donating an organ.
Yes, absolutely.
You're giving somebody the opportunity of life. I do want to jump to a recent thing that I read in regards to new science happening in the donation department, which is donating organs that from a pig. And the article that I read talked about kidneys being donated to a brain dead recipient who the kidneys did. It was a quote successful donation or transplant, I guess I should say. And then a heart that was transplanted into a live recipient. And presumably, hopefully, that's still going well as well. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I'm curious to know what they consider. I'm sure there's different steps, but a quote success, a donation success. And I'm sure, you can discuss more on that.
Yes. So this is a fascinating area of transplantation. The area you're referring to is broadly classified as xenotransplantation. Xenotransplantation mm-hmm. refers to transplantation from one species to another. In this case, we are talking about pigs to humans. Xenotransplantation research has been done for 30 or 40 years. There have been isolated cases of xenotransplants in humans that have been performed. In Pittsburgh, Tom Starzl performed a baboon to human liver transplant, and there's a heart transplant that was performed in the 90s, largely with not much success, because our species knows how to protect itself from other species in terms of the immune system. But so we have antibodies built against other species. And so if you try to put a pig organ into a human, the human body immediately reacts and rejects it, calling it, it's called hyperacute rejection. Was related to a certain type of sugar molecule that was expressed in the pigs, which the human's tissue does not possess, and therefore was identified as foreign and rejected right away. This was the age-old issue with xenotransplantation. So over time, they tried to knock out that one particular sugar that they identified was so important. So we had a new category of pigs called GAL knockout pigs, which they tried doing some work with. Even that was met with better success, but not quite where we needed it to be. More recently, in the last few years, what has changed is gene editing. So most of what we do today, the success that's been achieved in the last over the last few months should be attributed to the advances in gene therapy and gene editing. So now mm-hmm. we're able to modify genes to be able to present themselves differently. So things such as clotting, rejection, inflammation, the natural responses of the body to a foreign tissue can be modulated by altering the genes in the pigs so that they do not pose those same triggers to the human to start reacting. So that is the advance. There's been a lot of animal experiments in this area. And finally, they came to about three different clinical transplants that have been performed in the last few months. The first one was at NYU, Dr. Montgomery's team. where they did a genetically modified pig kidney into a brain dead recipient. The reason they chose a brain dead recipient is because obviously they wanted to make sure they show proof of principle that it can actually work without acutely rejecting, because the immune system is still intact, the brain doesn't function. Mm-hmm. So they put that in and it lasted 2 days, and they were able to show that the kidney made urine, and that was proof of principle. The University of Alabama replicated that, and they had their organ in for about 77 hours, which is a little over 3 days. So both of those showed good proof of principle. Meanwhile, at the University of Maryland, they actually were able to do it in a live human recipient model, not a brain dead model. And the reason for that was they identified a patient in heart failure who was receiving a heart assist device, who was too sick, the category we talked about earlier. Someone's too sick for transplant. Right. The risk of surgery is so much they will not survive a heart transplant that's done the routine way. So they were given up by all centers. In fact, I was told by one of my cardiothoracic colleagues that they referred this patient to five of the leading centers in the country to assess their candidacy for a human-to-human heart transplant, and all the centers said that he would not qualify based on the fact he's too sick.
Wow.
And therefore, for him, this was a Hail Mary of sorts, right? So it was no longer... So for him, this was something that was better than the alternative. So he signed up to receive a pig heart that was genetically modified with 10 different genetic edits, I believe, to control inflammation, clotting, and multiple other mechanisms that could lead to a reaction from the recipient. And so that was transplanted successfully, and the patient was on still heart and lung support for a couple of weeks. Again, I got an update yesterday at LifeSource from a cardiothoracic surgeon that the patient came off of the heart and lung support machine about 2 or 3 weeks after, and is doing well. That's the report. So that's a great breakthrough. We haven't had that kind of success in the field as of yet. It's, of course, we have to be cautious because it's an N of one, and it's very early in the phase of, it's still proof of principle only. Whether this can be reproduced across multiple patients and multiple scenarios remains to be seen. And then there's a whole another scenario, which is what are the untoward effects that can occur from this? There's nothing that we saw in 2 to 3 weeks, but altering genes and modifying these genetic edits, do they have other unintended consequences there in the recipient that we will see long term? Those are things that we always worry about, but this very cautious optimism and excitement based on these early results. There's also a question of whether or not you could have any transmissions of infections from animals to human. There are other examples, famous viral illnesses that I don't need to mention that have jumped from animals to human. And so those are kind of things that one has to worry about. And then the ethics of, animal to human transplants also has to be considered. So there's a lot of things to be considered and talked about. But first is proof of principle and knowing that it can actually work. And they've shown that in the short term, in an N of one patient, that they could make it work. And that's a significant breakthrough.
Thank you so much. We're about out of time. I would encourage people that, my comment to the ethics is that people are eating these animals. So come on. And to me, there's no greater gift than the gift of a life. So if you can save someone's life, why not? I'm sure the pigs are well raised. Give people once more the place where they can go to find out more about transplantation and how they can do it, please.
Yes. So again, like I said, if you're planning to be an organ transplant donor, especially in the kidney area, you can either go to the mHealth website or to the National Kidney Registry website for information on it. The kidneyregistry.org is the website for National Kidney Registry. mhealth.fairview.org for our center. Then there's National Kidney Foundation that has a lot of information on kidney transplantation. There are similar sites for liver and other organs as well. I would say sign up to be a donor, whether it's a living donor or a deceased donor, and help out another human being. It will this will make a huge difference in eradicating chronic organ failure in this country, which is a significant problem.
Thank you, Dr. Kandaswamy. And I, too, have signed the back of my driver's license, so I am a believer. So I encourage everyone to take a look at this. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. This has been Disability and Progress. The views expressed on the show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. This is KFAI 90.3 FM Minneapolis and KFAI.org.
KFAI.org.